Let me begin with two objects which do not fit. The first does not fit in a very obvious way. It is an anonymous early Ming Chinese painting of grooms with a horse, cut out of its original context and collaged into an album of drawings of various provenances, categories we would now call Islamic, European and Chinese, assembled in Iran in 1544-5 for the brother of the Safavid Shah Tahmasp. The fact of its insertion into a context for which it was not originally designed is presented to us visually, in the way it transgresses the frame of the page, hooves and ears spilling over the boundaries to jut awkwardly into the margins, and Chinese hats intruding into the calligraphic border, which reads, "These paintings are from the collection of good works by the Chinese masters." The second does not fit at a more epistemological level. It comes from a collection of calligraphic rubbings assembled in 1489 by the Crown Prince of Jin, one of the appanages of the Ming ruling house, with its seat at the city of Taiyuan in North China's Shanxi province. The Baoxian Tang Ji Gu Fa Tie, collection of calligraphic specimens assembled in the hall for treasuring worthies, is an important assemblage of such rubbings, a project of canon formation of a type with which the politically powerless princes of the Ming collateral houses were particularly involved. The rubbings remain important points of reference in the ongoing project of Chinese calligraphy connoisseurship, a project with a history of well over 1,000 years, which has itself generated an immense literature and a degree of sophistication possibly unparalleled in any other form of the practice of visual discrimination in human history. The particular image I'm showing you, however, has no place in that ongoing practice. It purports to show in rubbing form, that is, in the reproduction of calligraphy on stone, the writing of Zhang Jie, whose traditional dates put him around 2650 BC. Historian of the Yellow Emperor, possessor of four eyes, each with two pupils, he created the Chinese script, inspired by the tracks left by birds and beasts in the mud. Here, therefore, we have not just the first writing, but the first writer, a sacred point of origin for the many calligraphic masters whose work fills the 12 chapters of the Hall for Treasuring Worthies collection. Except that it's not. For connoisseurs from the 18th century, and probably even for some at the time, this sort of thing has the same status as we would now accord to a signed photograph of Shakespeare. Not so much a fake as an impossibility, a reproduction of something which never existed in the first place. It cannot fit into the history of calligraphy, except as an example of the sort of self-aggrandizing sloppiness now seen as typical of these Ming princely collections, usable only if embarrassing elements like this are edited out. Now, in commencing with things which do not fit, I want to open out a larger theme. It might be imagined, as someone whose published work deals almost entirely with images and objects of Chinese provenance, but I would come before you to talk about the ways China and its art have not fitted into the discipline of art history, and make a claim for the expansion of the remit of art history to take better account of the Chinese case. On the contrary, I want to argue that China has fitted only too well, and that it is only by reversing the process of putting China in its place that we will get anywhere. To do this, I want to take a detour through certain aspects of the history of that placing before returning at last to my two ill-fitting objects of study. Let me go back about 100 years. One of the more intriguing what-ifs of European art history emerges from the letters of the great connoisseur and sage of Italian Renaissance art, Bernard Berenson, who wrote in a letter from his Tuscan sanctuary, Itati, in 1914, "I look forward with zest to seeing what the dealers have of Chinese art to show me. Would I were young, or at least well, and I'd chuck everything to go to China." The following year, he reiterated in another letter, "How I wish I were now starting out in life. I should devote myself to China as I have to Italy." Bunsen was himself an enthusiastic acquirer of Chinese art up to the First World War, and his collection, a fairly typical mix for the period of interesting problems and highly optimistic early attributions, remains in his Italian villa to this day. The fact that he could have devoted himself to China, had he really wanted to, is shown by the parallel career of his Finnish contemporary and rival, Oswald Siren, who in the very year of 1914, in which Berenson first expressed a longing for the East, turned his attention decisively from the art of the Italian Renaissance to that of China. It is for his work on Chinese art that Siren is now remembered, and consequently is remembered by many fewer in Europe. His name has none of Berenson's battered but still potent aura. The moral of Berenson's fame and Siren's relative oblivion is not, or at least I hope not, that attention to Chinese art is a way to languish in decent obscurity. Rather it is that it is the way in which China is put in place within the discipline which matters. In 1903, already established as a dominant figure in the connoisseurship of Italian Renaissance art, Berenson published in the Burlington Magazine a two-part article entitled A Sienese Painter of the Franciscan Legend. This is devoted to the work of Stefano di Giovanni, better known as Sassetta, several of whose works Berenson himself owned. In the heightened style which won him so many admirers, but which perhaps reads less smoothly in less confident times, Berenson opens with an extended meditation not on achievement, but on failure. The failure of European visual art to engage effectively with the spiritual world, by comparison with the effectiveness of literature in this regard. But then he engages in a more daring comparison. Are the figure arts incapable of conveying a sense of things spiritual? If we confined our attention to European art alone, it would seem so. For our painting is apparently powerless to get out of the human figure more than an expression of heroism, of grandeur, of the superhuman. Always something in the nature of the physically impressive. But if we turn to the extreme Orient, we find that their arts of design do convey a sense of spiritual things. He goes on to drive this point home through a specific illustrated example, comparing Albrecht Dürer's woodcut of St. Gregory saying Mass to a Chinese painting of the 12th century. Significantly, the Dürer is unillustrated. A Burlington reader could be expected to look it up, if not conjure it up. But the Chinese painting is. It's one of a celebrated group of paintings of Lohan, or Buddhist saints, which had been brought from Japan for exhibition in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts in 1894 and subsequently sold. The picture shows what Berenson took to be Buddhist saints and lay devotees in a cave adoring scriptures, which emit a holy radiance. After an extensive ekphrasis of the scene, Berenson launches the full force of his rhetoric. Here we feel an ecstasy of devotion and vision. Here we behold a transubstantiation of body into soul, whereof we rarely get as much as a vanishing glimpse in our own art. Beside this design, the most religious achievements of a Dürer grow sterile or commonplace. Significantly, Berenson raises the obvious and then widespread Orientalist explanation that Orientals are intrinsically more mystical and spiritual, only to dismiss it. For him, the fault is something integral to European art. Quote, among the reasons, therefore, to be given for the great superiority as religious expression of Buddhist to Christian art, we must place to the front the fact that Sino-Japanese design is almost exclusively an art of contours, of values of movement, and in its own way, not ours, of space composition. And if this be so, we are left to wonder whether of European schools of design, that one which approached Oriental art closest in its means of expression would not be most successful in conveying a sense of the spiritual. The language is convoluted, but the meaning soon becomes clear. The art of Siena, and within it the oeuvre of Sassetta, and within that a painting which Berenson himself owned, is precisely that European school of design which approaches Oriental art most closely in its means of expression, and hence is most successful in conveying a sense of the spiritual. To put it bluntly, he says, of European schools of design, none has come so close to those of the Far East as the school of Siena during the 14th and early decades of the 15th centuries. However, Siena's achievements in the field of spirituality are still seen as limited, are still on the weaker end of his ongoing comparison. Far be it for me to claim for them that they have extracted out of the events presented all their spiritual significance. A great Chinese master would have been more on a level with the high inspiration of the subject. The great Chinese master may be great, but he is here still nameless, although in fact the paintings are signed. And the terrific confidence in the language can easily stop us from pausing to remember just how little Chinese or Japanese art someone like Berenson had actually seen in 1903. The sweep of the rhetoric can also hinder us from paying attention to what Berenson is saying here, and significantly, to what he's not saying. Nowhere does he use a word which Michael Baxendall has taught art history to be wary of, influence. Nowhere does he say that there is any causal connection between Sienese and Oriental painting. He says something much more radical than that, which is that Chinese painting is just better. In making a comparison here, he is making a judgment of quality. In a wary engagement with the whole issue of what comparison as the central form of engagement with art has the effect of doing, Mika Ball has written that it quickly becomes a ground for relative judgment and establishing hierarchies, and it distracts from looking. The centrality of comparison is nowhere more evident than the ways in which, Berenson being a prime example, the art of China and of Europe have been spoken of together, whether explicitly or implicitly. It may be hard now to think ourselves into the decade before the First World War, when it still made sense to publish in the Burlington Magazine an unashamed paean to the Chinese master who was a better artist than Albrecht Dürer, never mind Sassetta. But such types of comparison had, even then, a global reach. The year after Berenson wrote his, in 1904, his slightly older contemporary, the politician and thinker Kang Youwei, made his first visit to Italy, and wrote extensively in his diary of the art he was seeing there for the first time. For Kang, preoccupied as he was with images of China's decline and its threatened position in the face of rampant imperialism, schema of global comparison came naturally to mind. In a manner which would have gladdened Vasari's heart, he divided the history of Western painting into a stiff, lifeless before and a vital after, which was both realistic and, more importantly, scientific, based on the laws of perspective. Now, Kang Youwei knew a bit more about the history of painting in Europe than Berenson did of that in China, but they shared a confidence in their own understanding which made sweeping pronouncements all too easy. Kang Youwei placed the turning point at Raphael, for him the first great European master, in front of whose achievements he was moved to exclaim, "The painting of our country is shallow and desultory, far inferior to his. It must be reformed." But the roots of China's failure were also the source of that reform and revival. Kang believed that both veristic representation and the technique of oil painting were themselves Chinese inventions, transmitted to Europe from East Asia by Marco Polo. All Chinese art had to do, then, was to return to its own more remote past in the Sun and Yuan periods, i.e. prior to the 14th century, when it had been far superior to the then stiff and lifeless art of Europe. In 1910, 6 years after Kang Youwei stood in front of a Raphael and planned a resurgence of Chinese art, Berenson republished his lengthy Sassetta article in book form as A Sienese Painter of the Franciscan Legend. In the preface to this, he alludes vaguely to controversy generated by his arguments, stating, they gave rise to certain misunderstandings, which were probably due, in the first place, to the fact that they touched too rapidly upon too many things, and in the second place, to a question of emphasis. I had hoped to clear my meaning by adding three other essays, elaborating what I had to say about the religious paintings of China and Japan, but I've found no time for this in the 6 years that have passed. 8 years after that, Berenson was still teasing the readers of his essays in the study of Sienese painting by the near inclusion of a discussion of the relationships between Sienese art and the arts of the Far East. I was prevented from completing it in time for this volume, and much as I regret it in one way, in another, I'm not altogether sorry. In fact, the non-completion of this essay goes hand in hand with a footnote, which casts the relationship between Siena and East Asia in a completely different light from that which he had essayed in 1903. The note reads in part, "As is manifest in Pietro Lorenzetti's frescoes at San Francesco in Siena, at about this time, the arts and crafts of the contemporary Orient were beginning to invade Italy." Here the juxtaposition is quite different from that of 1903, when what was being said was not that Sienese art is in any way due to Chinese painting, but that it is like, if still inferior to, Chinese painting in some deeper sense. Now, if this notion of an Oriental influx was ultimately to prove a fantasy, it was not one unique to Berenson or to Kang Youwei. It fits into a wider fantasy of the extra-European sources of art, sometimes to be feared and sometimes to be embraced, but always through the 20th century, I would argue, necessary for the sustenance of the discipline of art history at quite profound levels. Choosing what to know and what not to know about the non-Western, a phrase students know is banned in the classroom, but which I shall use just this once, this has always been not a marginal concern, but a central one. We can, I think, see this by considering the ways in which the issue of Oriental influence has played out, a process in which certain misreadings of Berenson's early enthusiasm for the spirituality of Chinese art have played a crucial role. But before looking at these, it's worth considering the wider intellectual currents in which Berenson's sweeping comparison can be situated. One obvious point of reference, studied perceptively by Jasch Elsner, lies in the writings of Josef Strigowski. In 1901, 2 years before Berenson wrote, "Of European schools of design, none comes so close to those of the Far East as the school of Siena," Strigowski published his book Orient oder Rom, Orient or Rome, with its trenchant exposition of non-Mediterranean, indeed Eastern, points of origin for the art and architecture of late antique and early medieval Europe. Although intellectually, Berenson was probably closer to Strigowski's great rival, Alois Riegel, and it would be banal to suggest any direct causal connection, not least because of Strigowski's notorious anti-Semitism, Berenson did have Orient oder Rom in his library. At the least, these two very different men shared a willingness to see significant developments in European art as having not entirely autochthonous points of reference. Perhaps more important is the wider tendency within the humanities and social sciences of the late 19th and early 20th century for what has been called an especially ambitious kind of generalized historical comparison in the search for a single intelligible global process. Monuments of this world history would include once well-known names like Winwood Reade, author of The Martyrdom of Man, as well as H.G. Wells, Oswald Spengler, Toynbee, and of course Marx. The 1930s and 1940s have been proposed as the high point of this highly relativist, comparative cross-cultural models of history, seen perhaps largely under the impact of Marxism as scientific. But it's worth considering whether, just as art history was arguably the first form of cultural history, it is in art history, well before the 1930s, that some of these global comparative constructions were first given their fullest forms. Although perhaps now discredited among professional historians who've grown suspicious of the unity of history, the new discipline of global history seems to me to be something else altogether, the phantasm of world art studies is anything but extinct, and attempts to write total global histories of art have persisted, from Ernst Gombrich's 1950 Story of Art to Julian Bell's 2007 Mirror of the World. In the middle of the 1930s, there appeared a volume which shares some of the features of Berenson's comparativist enterprise by an author who shares none of his fame. I.V. Puzina is not a name to conjure with, and this émigré Russian historian's 1935 book, La Chine, l'Italie et les débuts de la Renaissance, is a forgotten curiosity, retrieved for me from remote Bodleian storage by the kindness of Claire Hills Nova. The title, China, Italy, and the Beginnings of the Renaissance, tells you all you need to know about this curious work, which is the most consistent and certainly the most lengthy attempt to argue for an East Asian point of origin for developments in European painting in the 14th and early 15th centuries. Given the importance of these developments, centering on the canonical names of Giotto and Duccio to accounts of Western art, the hypothesis is a bold one. To put it bluntly, for Puzina, Chinese influence caused Renaissance art. But significantly, this is not claimed by him as an original idea, rather as an old topic now being given a fuller treatment. Quote, "The question of the influence of Chinese painting on the painters of the Trecento has often been discussed in the literature, but it has never been the object of a dedicated study." He immediately cites Berenson in his 1903 article as the first to compare the religious art of the Sienese to Chinese art. It was above all in the work of Sassetta that he noticed a Far Eastern air. Such an explanation of the art of Sassetta is a pure intuition on Berenson's part, for which he declines to give a justification. Now we should pause here to remember that Berenson's comparison, as he made it in 1903, in fact, in no way involves any agency of East Asia as an explanation of the work of Sassetta. Rather, the comparison operates at the level of a vague homology. Only in 1918 had Berenson begun to speak of the arts and crafts of the contemporary Orient invading Italy. In the text which follows, Puzina joins a full historical exposition of Catholic and particularly Italian missions to the Mongol Yuan dynasty, ruling in China down to 1368, to a series of formalist comparisons between Italian painting and Chinese painting. And thereby he arrives at the conclusion that, quote, "At the beginning of the 15th century, a number of artistic innovations appeared in Italian painting. These innovations coincide with the traditional art of Chinese painters of the same period." In his final sentences, he is unequivocal. Chinese culture was imitated by the Italians of the 14th century. It still exercised its influence at the beginning of the 15th century, as we have just seen. This influence shows itself, above all, at the place where imitation does not require as a precondition a knowledge of the Chinese language or intellectual milieu. But this influence is not limited to the imitation of Chinese painting. It is much wider, and this confirms yet one more time our conviction of the influence of Chinese painting on the art of the Trecento. Now, just to pause for a moment in case anyone is wondering. Puzina's argument is nonsense, and his Chinese influence on Trecento painting is as fantastical as, if more honestly argued than, the Chinese visitors to Florence in a more recent popular example of this sort of diffusionist bad history, Gavin Menzies' 1434, the year a Chinese fleet sailed to Italy and ignited the Renaissance. It would be neat, at this point, to be able to link Puzina back to a wider and significant intellectual current in his Russian émigré intellectual milieu, that of Eurasianism, which, with echoes of Strigovsky and Spengler, sought to dismiss the cultural exceptionalism of Western Europe, but I don't have the evidence to go there. What I do want to stress is that we're not talking about a lone eccentric. However, by the time he wrote, the tide was turning against grand synthesizing attempts to link the art of East and West, as the universally skeptical, if still respectful, reviews of his book show. For example, the historian of science George Sarton demurred from his central line of reasoning. To establish this argument, one must at the very least prove the existence of a Chinese pictures in Italy at this period, and I do not know of a single example of this type. Leonardo Olschke began in a 1944 article by accepting that, quote, the Oriental influence of Italian art of the late Middle Ages and Renaissance has been frequently discussed during the last decades. However, naming and shaming Pusina and his successors, he lays into their fanciful hypotheses hasty conclusions, systematically demolishing all the examples they provide before stressing, in a possible allusion to Berenson, the vague conformity of some stylistic aspects of early Sienese paintings to Chinese art of the Yuan period, and a few scattered Asiatic types occasionally represented by Italian painters, cannot compare to the primordial and uninterrupted flow of cultural and artistic ideas from the Near East into the Mediterranean sphere. He attacks Berenson more directly when he gets to one of the prime examples of supposed Oriental influence, Ambrogio Lorenzetti's fresco of the martyrdom of Franciscan friars at Ceuta in San Francesco, Siena. Much discussed on the grounds of what were seen as East Asian costume and facial features of background figures. This is the very same fresco mentioned in Berenson's 1918 footnote as indicating the invasion of Italy by the arts and crafts of the Orient. Olschke, almost certainly correctly, finds an explanation for Asian facial features in Italian painting, not in the import of Chinese art, for which there remains to this day no evidence at all, or in the return with sketches of Italian sojourners in China, a similarly unsubstantiated claim, but instead in the ethnic diversity of medieval Italy, and in the presence there of large numbers of Asian slaves. Olschke's article has often been cited and seems to have largely killed off the issue of Chinese influence on Renaissance art, at least in respectable art historical circles. This once hotly debated topic has lost its claim on the attentions of the wider field. No one now cares. It might be thought that a distinctive turn in the discipline of art history over the past few decades has been an increasing attention to work from outside the European canon. Indeed, it might be thought that my presence here, as someone whose entire career to date has been addressed to China, is a symptom of that development. And perhaps it is. But I would wish to argue that, counterintuitively, China has always had a place in the history. Indeed, that putting China in its place has always been one of the acts that made the constitution of a history of art, particularly a singular history of art, possible. And I would argue that this goes back a long way. Over 60 years ago now, a piece by Michael Sullivan, the doyen of Chinese art studies in this country, by whose presence here tonight I'm very honoured, drew attention to the place of Chinese art in one of the foundational texts of non-Italian art writing, in Joachim von Sandrart's 1675 Deutsche Akademie der Bau, Bild und Malerei Kunst. Here, in this first European description of Chinese painting, Sandrart principally does two things, for the first time, but certainly not for the last. He tells us what Chinese painting is, and he tells us how it compares with European work. Quote, they set everything down singly, in outline only, without shadows or modelling, but washed over quite simple with colours of their kinds. They do not know how to set off figures, each according to its true quality, whether it be before or behind, or how to observe such other aspects of naturalism. It is not a little to be wondered at that such otherwise clever people have no knowledge whatsoever of the art of perspective. And Sandrart goes on to tell us about four actual curious pictures which I have obtained from the Chinese themselves, with ridiculous archaic figures. Now, four may not be a large number, and their authority is further diminished by the fact that what Sandrart was looking at may well not have been Chinese paintings at all, but illustrations in the volumes on China of Athanasius Kircher and Ulfa Dapper, but it is enough. However flimsy the evidence base, Chinese art begins as a known and a coherent entity. And this remains so whether we are talking about Sandrart, or Berenson, or Ernst Gombrich, who lists an eccentrically chosen three Chinese painters in The Story of Art, a book which famously begins, "There is no such thing as art, there are only artists." All of them were familiar with a pathetically small number of actual individuated works of Chinese art. And so it has remained. On countless occasions, Chinese art comes into play at the edge of our field of vision. One of the readings at the memorial service for the late Francis Haskell was the very moving passage in Proust describing the death of the writer Bergotte, who defies his doctor's orders to check on a detail in Vermeer's View of Delft. Quote, "so finely painted that it possessed, if considered in isolation, the self-sufficient beauty of some precious Chinese work of art." Proust's critic is as unnamed as the precious Chinese work of art, which Vermeer's patch of wall recalls, but neither of them needs to be, in order for them to fulfil their role at the edge of a larger narrative. The problem then is not, as I am quite often still told by nervous students, that we know nothing about Chinese art. The problem is that we already know everything about it. It is entirely a known quantity. As the Macedonian writer Suzana Milevska has put it in the context of a debate on is art history global, quote, "perhaps the reason art history is not global now, and I believe it would be naive to think it is the result of earlier art history, which had all the answers ready at hand before it was even written, and was based on the limited experience of its writers." And therein lies the central issue. Far from arguing for the inclusion in the art historical canon of hitherto neglected or disregarded material, I find myself forced to propose that we need to forget the discipline's claim that we already know everything about Chinese art, if we wish to learn anything at all. But I wish to take the conceit one turn further. For I would argue that although Chinese art is fully in place as an object of art historical knowledge, it has been one of the conditions of that knowledge as possibility that it needs to forget that it already knows everything about it. This is a process observable in writing from the second half of the 20th century, associated with the professionalisation of the discipline and strikingly visible in the person of Berenson himself. If we revisit the ancient sage Berenson of 1950, the place of China has shifted considerably from the one it held for him 50 years earlier. In a short essay entitled Exotic Arts, that place has become a marginal one. Quote, "compared with our art of the last 60 centuries, with its endless variety of subject matter, of material, of kind and quality, every other art, Chinese included, is limited. Even Chinese, the most valuable of all the arts from beyond our pale, can offer students of visual representation its landscape only, as an achievement that our painters have not equaled or surpassed. The exotic arts soon weary. As is the case with yogi theosophies, Mazdanianism, and similar appeals, it is craving for mere otherness that draws us to them rather than any unique superiority of their own. Nor can we devote ourselves with advantage to intensive study of them." Well, that's certainly me put in my place. But rather than stepping from the podium now, I would insist that it is hard not to see this progress from enthusiasm to weary disdain as a psychological process of repression. This process parallels the way proper art history came to be less open to the kind of grand comparative gesture which had seemed meaningful before 1939, as it became professional and specialised. The inclusion of Chinese art and archaeology in the syllabus of the Courtauld Institute from 1933 to the Second World War, for instance, and its consequent exclusion after that date, is a fact now little known and little acknowledged. For most of the great figures of post-war art history, for Edgar Vint and Francis Haskell, China simply became that of which one did not speak, conscious, perhaps, that to do so risked the kind of unscholarly gush associated with the increasingly unacceptable Berensonian mode of aesthetic waffling. A professional discourse of Chinese art history developed, confined in Britain to the School of Oriental and African Studies, but it too was heir to the kind of repression of which I've been speaking, careful to avoid the kind of fragile hypothesis of someone like the now totally forgotten Puzina. Gombrich's placing of China over there in the story of art, in the East towards which we look, is an important final step in making unsayable the kind of utterances about China which the Berenson of 1903 felt so comfortable with, and the Berenson of 1950 wished to forget he had ever said. However, the Chinese objects in the Villa Itati collection remained about the aging Berenson. They were not disposed of, though they were never added to, material memories of earlier forms of desire. Another great collector interested in universals, Sigmund Freud, did continue through the 1930s to buy Chinese works, but he too chose not to speak of them when he said in 1931, "I have sacrificed a great deal for my collection of Greek, Roman and Egyptian antiquities, and actually have read more archaeology than psychology." The now large literature on Freud as a collector follows him in its discussion principally of the Mediterranean aspects of his things. The Chinese art, which literally stared him in the face as he wrote, goes unmentioned. It's certainly true that Freud's library, especially those most treasured books he chose to bring with him from Vienna to London, contain almost none of the available literature of the day on Chinese art, and he preferred to address it at the level of the non-verbal. But I cannot resist pointing out that his preferred breed of dog was the Chow, believed by fanciers to have Chinese origins, and that his favourite pet was called Lun. Lun is Chinese for theory. Make of that what you will. As we all know, that which has been repressed has a way of returning. This basic fact has been drawn on by the art historian Stanley Abbey in his work on the ways in which it was necessary for the success of abstract impressionism in post-war America that the empirically verifiable engagement on the part of several artists with what he calls an oriental mode, principally via the medium of calligraphy, be systematically denied and refused. He sees fantasy, in its technical sense not of a mistake, but as a failure to recognise, which is fundamental to our subjectivity, as well as the structuring of what we call reality. He sees this as central to the way in which the Chinese script and Chinese visual signs functioned as part of the conditions of possibility for modernist poetics and modernist art in the mid-20th century. I'd see this fantasy as constructed from the long, and very long if we go back to Sand art, history of repression, expressed in the idea that China and by extension Chinese art are simultaneously utterly inscrutable, unknowable, and at the same time totally known. As we've seen, that knowledge has always provided the grounds for comparison, more powerful when it's implicit or even denied. But does it have to be so? Mika Ball has written of the possibility that, quote, "there are, however, other forms of comparison, not built on a logic of oppositional judgment. Comparison can be a tool for analysis as long as one of its terms is not established as normative." And she's argued that if this is done, quote, "instead of an instrument of judgment, it becomes a source of differentiation." A project I find myself drawn to with a wistful, possibly utopian sense that this might actually be achievable is the exhibition L'Empire Interdit, Forbidden Empire, Visions of the World of the Chinese and Flemish Masters, held at the Palais des Beaux-Arts in Brussels and the Palace Museum in Beijing in February to September 2007. It was conceived by the Belgian painter Luc Tijmans and the Chinese art historian Yu Hui, and is perhaps better approached itself as an installation piece than an exhibition of discrete works, since here the sum is definitely different from the parts. The exhibition juxtaposes an equal number of Chinese and Flemish paintings from the 15th to the early 20th centuries. What draws me back to this catalogue? The exhibition was poorly advertised, and I deeply regret not seeing it. What draws me back to the catalogue is the way in which juxtaposition or comparison is here used to avoid saying one kind of thing, to refuse the weighing of a totalised this with an equally totalised that. We get pairings on successive pages, such as Franz Probst's portraits of the Archdukes Albert and Isabella, with Qing imperial images of the Qianlong emperor and his consort, which function at an obvious level of subject continuity, where similarity is obvious. But we also get, for example, Wang Yuanqi's landscape, alongside Jan Karl Verbrugge's drawing of a monstrous fetus, where I at least found myself thinking about the ways in which in the two painting traditions it is the human body and the contours of the earth, respectively, which function as central subject matter, and in which deviance and norm are visually constructed in two different ways. We get a striking juxtaposition, like Chun Lu's plum blossom with two panels after Memling, Descent from the Cross in St. Andrew. At first glance, difference is total. The human body, the plant world. Oil on canvas, ink on silk. Monochrome colour, religious narrative, refusal of narrative. As I look at these in the context of the total exhibition, I find I'm forced to speculate. Are we meant to think formalistically about the role of the diagonal, or to recall a visual culture in which these things are embedded at the point of their creation, each imbricated with a vast textual record of plum blossom poetry no less than of devotional texts? How valid might be my thought that the plum blossom, earliest of the flowering plants of the new year, stands in some homologous way as an image of renewal, even of resurrection? Probably not valid at all, in a general sense, but I think the larger point being made by the range and quantity of comparisons in Forbidden Empire is that no single type of comparison will do. The relationship between a range of diverse Chinese images and diverse Flemish ones cannot be reduced to a comparison of stable entities. Baal's hope for comparison as the grounds of differentiation rather than judgment has possibly been glimpsed on the horizon, if not yet actually reached. Let me return in conclusion to the two things that do not fit, or at least cannot be put in place, in the sense that the totally known Chinese art of Gombrich or Berenson can occupy its sort of place. I want to say as clearly as I can that I do not think their exclusion from the canon is the result of some Orientalist plot, and that if only we could take the Chinese approach to art, all would be well. The anonymous professional painting of horses and grooms, described as a good work in Safavid Iran, and the rubbing reproducing the calligraphy of the demiurge Sun Jie, are equally not in place in current accounts of art history written in Chinese. And the increasingly voiced call for a Chinese approach in the discipline seems to me nostalgic and regressive, embodying what has been described as a vernacular cosmopolitanism, driven in fact by a concentration on the metropolitan culture of the West. But we do need to know more about these things, engage more fully with a huge range of unstudied aspects of China's past, or, at the very least, acknowledge that the enormous variety and diversity of visual and material culture in China's past is ill-served by deciding that this, and only this, is what Chinese art is about. This is so whether it be the Safavid artist Dost Mohammed telling us that the image of grooms and horses is one of a collection of outstanding works by the good Chinese masters, or Berenson and Gombrich's emphasis on spirituality. None of them had looked at enough to form those judgments with any credibility. And neither have I. Neither has any of us. When we have, it will not just be art in China which looks different, since, as I hope I have demonstrated, Chinese art has been an essential component in the construction of a larger story of art which has consoled us for a century or so. And what I am saying holds true for other equally constructed components too: Islamic art, African art, Indian art, non-Western art. Thankfully, the Bersian Tang calligraphy collection can never be part of a universal story of art, not least because what you see is too much of a reproduction, or rather a projected scan of a photograph of a rubbing of a carving of something which never existed. Too much of a reproduction to be an authentic component of any monoglot narrative. The Chinese pictures in an album in 16th century Iran will, I am pleased to say, always be in the wrong place, as equally implausible in Islamic art as they are problematic in a single unified field of Chinese art. Their presence in the wrong place predates the invention of the right place for them to be in the nationalist narratives of the 19th and 20th centuries, and hence shows us graphically the insufficiency of those narratives. The frame, which almost but does not quite confine, can only recall in turn those larger framing devices which art history has constructed as its own conditions of possibility, and raise the possibility that by putting some stress on those frames, through more attention to the ill-fitting, we might have an art history which relied less on a place for everything and everything in its place, and more on an unafraid engagement with the full range of historic human creativity, including the vast body of that creativity, which is too varied and too rich to be constrained simply as Chinese art. Thank you.